Hello and welcome to Movies We Dig, a podcast about film, antiquity, and everything in between. I'm Elijah Fleming.
I'm Christy Vogler.
And I'm Colin McCormick.
And today we're uncovering The Lost City.
You like the little word change I made?
Yes.
It almost tripped me up.
You got to keep them on your feet. That's what I always say. You got to like just change it up because we'll read anything I write.
Yes, you're going to write something really weird next time, I'm sure. We are uncovering The Lost City, a 2022 action-adventure comedy film directed by the Nee brothers, starring Sandra Bullock, Channing Tatum, and Daniel Radcliffe.
Which made me so happy.
I know.
Where's Brad Pitt? You forgot Brad Pitt.
Yeah, Brad Pitt is also
there. Pitt was like the sleeper star.
Yes. Oh my gosh. There will be spoilers in this. So if you have not seen this film yet, be prepared because that is like one of my favorite moments to quote is the
Why are you
what
so
happens
handsome?
To Brad Pitt?
Oh, yes.
No, the I can taste his thoughts.
That's so weird. Okay, well, I think I kind of have an idea of where we are with this movie, you guys, but I'm really curious about Colin's thoughts. So, Colin, do you dig this movie?
Yeah, I really dig this movie, actually. It was a lot of fun, just in terms of, like, I dig this on multiple levels. And one, it was just, like, an enjoyable action comedy. I'm always down for Sandra Bullock in a comedy role like this, a la, like, The Heat or something like that. This, I think, is also, like, the directors like are using Channing Tatum to his full potential in this movie. I think Channing Tatum is killing it. I think Sandra Bullock is killing it. They're both peak of their. I think Daniel Radcliffe is also being great in his own way. I think all the leads are great. It's a fun story. I don't really have much to say in terms of the actual like archaeology of the thing, other than it's just a kind of like this movie to me has more to do. Its vision of archaeology is really just born out of other movies like Romancing the Stone or something like that than, you know, anything sort of real. Though, you know, I'll defer to you two on that. But in general, I dug it.
Yeah, I was so excited for this film because, you know, I've seen my fair share of archaeology adventure films and I've not seen a fair share of them, which I'm sure will change before too long. But to me, this seemed like the perfect, like they were going to spoof it. And what I was really pleasantly surprised was it actually still maintained an archaeology adventure story. And yeah, it was a little bit of a spoof, but like it actually delivered on the discoveries. And we'll talk about the like interpretation and the rich versus cheap metaphor at the end. Because I was really surprised. I thought it was going to be a little bit spoofier, and it stayed true to the genre in a lot of ways, but was still being critical of it and doing it in a funny way that just made it really enjoyable. And Channing Tatum playing dumb jock is his niche. Like, he does it so well, and I love it every time.
It's not even just that he's, like, kind of simple. It's that he's so earnest. Like, I think that's, like, that's the vector, that he's so kind of pure and try hard and, like, hard on his sleeve and, like, sincere. And he does that so well.
He does.
So well.
And he's had other roles that, like, I saw him in Step Up, but, like, my favorite role that he is in is She's the Man with Amanda Bynes, where he basically is playing the same, not highly intelligent, but very earnest, dumb jock sort of motif. Like, he's very nice to look at. He's very athletic. He is leading with his heart, but what is the line? It's like, do you like cheese? So I have loved him in this kind of, you know, role every time he's done it. So I was happy to see it here again, too.
Yeah, I think I really agree with you guys. I wanted this to be something, and it was exactly what I wanted it to be. It was silly and fun, and I laughed, and I was invested in the characters. And it didn't take itself too seriously, which I think to its benefit, because I have also seen like the other big, I guess, like archaeology, quote unquote, adventure movie, Uncharted, which came out recently, which was a terrible, horrible, awful movie and had way less to do with archaeology.
And way more to do with like parkour.
Apparently, yes. And so,
that is what the newer Tomb Raider movie is like too, frankly.
The newer Tomb Raider has a extended fixie bike chase scene in London. It's the
that
most
is very cool. Yeah. That's a cool part. It has nothing to do with archaeology.
It reminds me, it's like, there's a scene in the new Tomb Raider where they're like, she works for some kind of like bike delivery messenger company, and they have this like thing where like one person is the fox and all the other bikers are trying to catch her, and there's like an extended fixie bike chase. And it is like, to me, it was like, it's so like of the moment of that movie that's going to age so poorly, in the same way that, like, if you've ever seen the Power Rangers Ivan Ooze movie, where there's like the first part of the movie, there is like a 5-minute rollerblade montage.
I saw that in theaters.
Yeah.
There's also a paratrooping montage.
Yeah. Yes. No. Yeah. Yeah. So that movie, it's like, it's so 1999. Like that movie starts with like skydiving and then immediately into a rollerblade sequence where they're like rollerblading through a construction site. And so like that, for that Power Rangers movie, is like the fixie bike chase for the new Tomb Raider movie. But I yield my time.
Yeah, Lige, we cut you off. What were you going to finish off with?
I don't even remember what I was saying.
This is a better movie than Uncharted and maybe
Tomb Raider. You were dumping on Uncharted, which stopped me from going to see it. So thank you for saving me.
It was stupid. It was so stupid.
I haven't seen Uncharted yet, but from what I've gleaned from the trailers, I think the real dividing difference between this movie and Uncharted is just a lack of self-awareness and a sense of fun.
Yes, absolutely. Because I felt like sad and depressed coming out of Uncharted. And I felt like, you know, joyful and smiling coming out of The Lost City. And I guess maybe that has to do with like what I want from movies nowadays. I don't want to feel sad and depressed.
Yeah.
But I, even beyond that, just sort of the use of archaeology as treasure hunting, which does happen in The Lost City, it's far more prevalent in Uncharted, and even in movies like Indiana Jones, which we do not have the time or space to like, and we will address. But there's so much more of that, like, illicit, illegal, like, nothing that is actual archaeology.
I guess also we should maybe back up just a second, just for listeners, because I know Eli and Christy and I have been talking about this for a minute now, but we are sort of this new zone, this era, the season, if you will, of the podcast, we're going to be focusing on sort of adventure archaeology movies. And we've got a few, I don't want to say it on air because I'm going to jinx it and the scheduling is going to fall through, but we have a few guests lined up to talk about different time periods and regions. But like the idea of this trope of like the adventure movie going into, you know, the lost city of whatever, the temple of blue, blue, blue to rescue, they're done to rescue, to pilfer.
Pilfer is a good word.
Yeah, to take treasure. And Eli mentioned the treasure, and that's, I mean, I think that's it's a staple of this genre, but also a staple of the earliest days of archaeological excavations, right? Because like
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, even our beloved mummy does this also, but it's sort of is taking place in that time period where the treasure hunter and the archaeologist are the same person.
Yeah. Yeah. It gets away with it because it's the 20s and that's what people were kind of doing. You know, they were looking for King Tut's tomb, and King Tut's tomb also happened to be full of gold.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is what I liked about Daniel Radcliffe's character as the evil eccentric billionaire who is
Abigail.
Yes.
Abigail Fairfax.
Abigail Fairfax. But like what I liked about that character and that role that's connected back to early archaeology ventures was also that you were not just looking for the stuff, but you were looking for kind of the prestige of finding.
Or the validation.
Like, exactly. Yeah. It was meant to validate. Heinrich Schliemann is famous for like actually, you know, he looked at the Iliad and he's like, hey, I bet this is a real place. I bet you we can find it. And he did. And I mean, there's that element there of what Daniel Radcliffe's character is trying to do is not just, he's after the crown of fire, but he's definitely wanting the validation of finding this.
Yeah, I think that's really smart. Like the character, his whole thing is daddy doesn't love me effectively, right? Like he's like, I need to prove it because my younger brother took over the company and like, you know, nobody respects. I need to do something that nobody has done before and prove and do the impossible, which is very much like that's sort of the plot of like Milo in Atlantis. or mm-hmm. Indiana Jones is always begrudgingly dragged into his adventures, but like other, you know, like everybody thinks this thing doesn't exist. I am convinced it exists and I will find them and prove the naysayers wrong, which like Christy was saying is like kind of what Heinrich Schliemann did. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one of those like how to summarize our complicated feelings on it of like, it's really cool that he found, you know, he excavated at Troy and Mycenae, but then also like
he also plowed through it.
Yeah.
Through it, if you will.
He literally blew his way through it with yeah. explosives.
Yeah.
But almost like we learned the wrong, I mean, this is apropos for Hollywood of like, talk about an industry where they learned the wrong lessons from great successes. Mm-hmm. but like, yeah, that seems, you know, the Heinrich Schliemann kind of in that he was proven right, maybe set some bad precedents.
Well, I don't think that goes away for archaeologists because at the end of the day, you know, we're speaking to societies that are thousands of years old. So to be proven right about something definitively, like that's really hard to come by. It's very rare. I joke that, you know, I argue for at Ganjavecchio that it's a female doctor who is operating in that space, but very short of like finding a burial or an epigraph that clearly names some mm-hmm. woman as the medica who worked here. I'm not going to get that validation. I'm not ever going to get that for sure answer. A lot of it is best guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that Sandra Bullock is a romance author. Like that's sort of our introduction to her.
Have you two seen Romancing the Stone?
Nope.
I have not.
Ah, this is where me, the philologist, comes in, which is like, this is the key intertext. Because Romancing the Stone is a Robert Zemeckis movie, 1984, starring Michael Douglas, Kathleen Turner, and Danny DeVito. And the plot of that movie basically is a romance novelist gets sucked into a treasure hunting ploy where like her sister-in-law is kidnapped by these like treasure hunters. And she teams up with Michael Douglas, who is like a, in the movie, he's like a bird, like an exotic bird smuggler or something. And they find the treasure for themselves. It's like very, very, very similar to this movie on the concept level. Mm-hmm. So cool. Anyway, in this movie, Sandra Bullock is a romance novelist who
was married to an archaeologist.
Yes.
Who was married to an archaeologist. Yes.
And had experience like translating a lost South American language. It's vague.
They were very unclear about like the actual real life, I guess, origins of it, which is fine. Like it doesn't have to be.
Yeah. We know that it's in the Atlantic and everybody, it's presumably like the Caribbean or South America.
Yeah.
In real life, they filmed in the Dominican Republic.
Okay.
But anyway, so she gets kidnapped by Daniel Radcliffe, who is a billionaire obsessed with finding the lost city of D, which is a play on the lost city of, I guess I should say Z, or the lost city of Z, this theory about a lost city in the Amazon.
Can we comment on that line? Because one of my favorite lines that Sandra Bullock has is like, why is it called Lost City of D? It's like, is it for Dick? And it's like, no, it's da 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 da. And it's like, but a bunch of white people couldn't figure out how to say it. So it got shortened to D. And I'm like, oh God. That's so true.
That's so real.
But then that comes back around because like the reason they're able to discover the city is because it's being pushed up and like only the tip is being like the volcano exposed the D.
So funny. Yeah. No, they had fun with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then Channing Tatum is the cover model.
He's the Fabio.
He's Fabio.
He even has like the long hair in one of his scenes and he goes off to rescue Sandra Bullock. And and then I guess very much like Romancing the Stone, they end up finding the treasure themselves.
Yeah, but in Romancing the Stone, it's like a big ass emerald. In this, there's a twist at the end, I guess, which we shouldn't spoil, I think.
Oh, we're going to. Because that's actually, that was something that Elijah pointed out of the interpretation of that moment. The cheap versus the rich metaphor thing was actually, Elijah, you say it, because like, I thought it was really insightful, actually.
I forget which part.
Sandra Bullock's interpretation.
The D, just the tip.
As opposed to, so Sandra Bullock's interpretation versus Daniel Radcliffe. Like, Daniel Radcliffe.
Oh, yeah, this part. So I guess the thing that we forgot to say was that Sandra Bullock's character, her archaeology husband, has recently died. Mm-hmm. And so she's having trouble writing her next novel, which is supposed to be romantic and adventurous and wonderful. And she feels miserable and just wants to sit in her bathtub and drink wine. which, like,
I feel attacked.
I know. I was like, I feel attacked. But her interpretation of the material and sort of versus Daniel Radcliffe's, where he is looking for, like, a big ass temple, like something huge, like, wouldn't they have wanted to, like, show the world how huge this was?
Mm-hmm.
And from a, like, a female centered perspective, she's like, no, in this ancient story, the woman's husband had died. And so she just wants to be alone. Of course, it would be hidden. Of course, it wouldn't be some huge thing that's easy to find. She just wanted to be alone, which really is just, you know, a female perspective on archaeological material.
And I wonder, too, perhaps, so this movie, originally, apparently, when this script was kind of in the getting passed around Hollywood, Sandra Bullock initially passed on it because she said it had been on the shelf for something like 7 years. And then she accepted it, but on the condition that Sandra Bullock is one of the producers.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if that has, I mean, I'm only sort of speculating over the sort of creative oversight she had, but if, like, there is a sort of gendered line to this movie where Daniel Radcliffe is obsessed with, like, this guy would have wanted, like, he wanted to build a pyramid, a tomb, a giant, you know, mm-hmm. beacon to his own awesomeness for other people, like, which is, you know, really Daniel Radcliffe. I mean, again, this is, I think, a motif of, like, you know, what we see in the past is very much like what we bring to it. You know, it's like the yeah. Yoda-ism, where it's like, what will I find in the cave? You know, only what you take with you. And
yes, exactly,
Daniel yeah. Radcliffe is taking the, like, as I want to, like, erect a monument to my awesomeness. Like, wouldn't this person in the past would have wanted to do the same? And he just, like, fundamentally misunderstands human beings.
Yeah, human nature.
Yeah, yeah. Or women specifically.
Well, and it goes to show, too, because the object that they're looking for is called the Crown of Fire. So even just hearing that, he is assuming crown for a king. And so he is mm-hmm. even looking for the king. Mm-hmm. And what he finds is that the crown was actually a gift for the queen. And, like, mm-hmm. she was the center of the story, not the man.
It was yeah. it was a courting, like, or a courtship, because we're starting at the end of the movie and working back.
I know, but we are.
That's fine.
And we haven't spoiled the biggest twist came much earlier in the movie, in my humble
opinion. Oh, really? I thought I saw that, not to, like, toot my own horn. Are we talking about Brad Pitt?
Yeah.
Do we want to keep talking about the crown, or we want to go back?
Let's
to
keep
Brad
talking
Pitt?
About the crown, and then we okay. can.
And then we can go back to Brad Pitt.
Because yeah, because the crown is sort of revealed that the crown is just
seashells.
Yeah, it's just seashells, and it's just a symbol of devotion that the husband sort of made this crown after he picked a seashell every year for a year, and, you know, she kept it, and so it had sentimental value, if not fungible economic value.
Well, and it was also, like, they were red seashells, which, if you study, oh gosh, what is the gift based on? There's a famous exchange system that
I know what you're talking about.
If
you have a gift-based economy,
Kula shells, yeah,
yeah, yeah,
where, like, shells in so many cultures have no value, except they were very valuable and prestigious in this one society. So again, Daniel Radcliffe is reading red rubies into mm-hmm. the Crown of Fire. And that's kind of what Sandra Bullock read into it, too, when she wrote her novel. But then it was this just natural, but still hard to acquire material.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I loved that there was no actual quote-unquote treasure.
Mm-hmm.
I loved that twist. I thought it was, like, the best thing the movie could have done. Like, the real treasure was the friends that we made along the way.
I actually used that. I've been lecturing on the Odyssey this past week, which is one of my favorite lectures. But I always like to have fun with my title slides. And so part two of my Odyssey lecture was the real Odyssey was the friends we made along the way. Which is ironic because Odysseus actually made zero friends.
And killed most of his,
yes,
his friends.
He in fact lost friends. It was a negative gain of friends in that story. But yeah, the treasure was inside of us. I don't know.
The whole time, yeah. Because yeah, it's Sandra Bullock sort of, you know, sees the people in her life who do really care about her. So, like, in addition to Channing Tatum coming after her, mm-hmm. like, her agent also is, like, on this odyssey
yeah,
to find her.
Divine Joy Randolph as Beth, her
yes.
publicist.
I love it.
Her
so
publisher.
It's so good. So yeah, it's more about the people in your life and your relationships with them, which is mm-hmm. exactly what the ancient story was. It was the mm-hmm. people in their lives, human nature.
Another thing I really like, well, so there's this one aspect of the film that maybe I thought, well, it felt a little undercooked, but maybe it was because, like, if we dwell too much on it, it becomes a totally different movie, which is the notion of, like, Daniel Radcliffe as the adventure explorer slash colonialist archaeologist, right? Where he comes in and he says something very early on where he's like, Raffi here thinks I'm like desecrating his culture and his heritage. But like, you know what I say? There aren't a lot of jobs to go around on the island.
Which is a reality for a lot of dig sites today still. Like that goes all the way back to when we were talking about the dig and how so much of archaeological work is done by local laborers that never get any credit for it. Yeah, that went straight to the heart to me. I'm like, oof.
Yeah.
That's how I know they were talking to an archaeologist, because they brought up some serious issues about what actually goes behind the archaeology adventure story. Well, there's actual exploitation and looting, and they acknowledged that. Like, that's what this was. And some people still don't care today. Like, Daniel Radcliffe, who cares? I'm rich.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I also, the other dimension that I really liked was that the sort of clue that Sandra Bullock realizes is that the key clue to interpreting the puzzle or the remains was like hidden in a folk song, right? Mm-hmm. Where that the sort of the local community, in a way, like preserved the memory. They had preserved the story, and like the story had survived in a, like, you know, again, I said at the beginning that I wouldn't have a lot to say about this as like a literary studies philologist type. I'm like, well, this is an oral tradition, and like this is going to preserve, you know, it's going to preserve memory. And like, it, you know, it ends up in this telephone process where like it comes out the other end, not exactly how it went in, but like there are kernels of like really interesting stuff that get buried and sort of preserved in like folk oral traditions. And one of them is like the story of this king and queen and like where their resting place lies and things like that.
Yeah, which totally still happens today. Like, local legends, local folklore is absolutely a thing that especially archaeologists in the United States I nowadays pay much more attention to than they have in the past. And I think it's so important that is definitely still a part of our world. Like, it hasn't gone away.
Yeah, going back to Schliemann, like, I remember when I was studying abroad in Greece, my teacher, when we went to Mycenae, was telling the story of, the way Schliemann found Mycenae was he showed up, asked some people, was like, hey, you know where Mycenae is? And they're like, yeah, that hill over there. Mm-hmm. Like, that was also an excellent moment of just folk knowledge can inform us a lot about the past, especially for prehistoric society.
Yeah.
Ugh. Yeah, there were so many beautiful moments that like touched my archaeologist's heart in this.
And this also was happening while Sandra Bullock is dancing with Channing Tatum. And we got to, again, I think this movie uses Channing Tatum very well. We get Channing Tatum to dance a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
And not like, it wasn't flashy. It wasn't, he didn't do a whole Magic Mike XLL, you know, on the table with the sparks or whatever. But yeah, like it was good. So I guess maybe working backwards, as we are wont to do, we should talk another inversion. This is ironic. Here's my observation. Us starting with this movie in a way is sort of working backwards from the genre. But
yes,
because this is the send up. But the biggest send up probably is in the character of like, well, Brad Pitt, but Brad Pitt vis-a-vis Channing Tatum.
Yes. Yeah. So when Sandra Bullock gets kidnapped, Channing Tatum's first thing that he does is, oh, I'm going to call this guy, this like ex-military guy who does this trainer. Extraction.
Because maybe he's a trainer. His name is Trainer.
It's like who he is in his phone or something.
With Susie Butt stuff.
That was crazy. And yeah, so it's Brad Pitt, and he like actually has the long hair that like Channing Tatum had a wig on for earlier, and it's like he's this weird almost
he's a parody
version. Yeah,
he's a parody simultaneously of like Michael Douglas's character in Romancing the Stone, like that trope, that kind of, or like Chris Pratt in Jurassic World, where like,
yes.
I mean, that was in like what, 2012, when did Jurassic World come out?
I don't even know anymore.
I should know this, but like, you know, Chris Pratt was like, it was like a dated, like, it was like, who is this asshole? But but Brad Pitt is like he's simultaneously a send up of that, but also kind of a send up of Brad Pitt, or that he's like too cool for school. And I just, the line that killed me was when he meets Sandra Bullock and she's like, why are you so handsome? And he goes, my dad was a weatherman. I don't know why, I just like died when he said that.
He'd explain so much. Yeah, like his character was so fun because also the car scene, he's like, yeah, I got a rental. And like Channing Tatum is like about ready to throw his stuff in the truck because there's that persona. And he's like, no, this little thing, this right here.
Yeah. Tiny little thing. He quotes like, he's always quoting like Sun Tzu or like, like Heraclitus or something. I love it. He had like all of like the beads and the necklaces and like sort of macho man jewelry.
Yep.
Just killing me. Like everything about his character.
Yep.
And I feel like some of the best interactions were those moments between Channing Tatum and Brad Pitt's characters, because like they're like Channing Tatum's so eager to help in any way he can. And like, this is what I love about Channing Tatum. And what I really appreciated this moment was the break into the camp, beat up a bunch of people, and save Sandra Bullock, where Brad Pitt is just handling himself like a professional. And Channing Tatum is trying to help. And what he is a very fit man. He is trained in, what is it, CrossFit?
So he's CrossFit certified.
He's CrossFit certified. But what I love that they did with them is like, just because you are an in-shape man does not mean you are capable of fighting. And he played that so well. I'm like, thank you. Just because you are in shape does not mean you are a martial artist, like martial arts specialist. And that is how this moment played out, like beautifully. Yeah, yeah. So good.
And then the sort of we spoiled the end, I guess, already. So we're deep into spoiler territory. The send up is Brad Pitt dies suddenly, because like in a different movie, in Romancing the Stone, Brad Pitt would have been our male lead.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and it would have been Brad Pitt.
Yep.
And here he gets sort of unceremoniously and randomly killed.
Right before that, though, I love that like Channing Tatum's only ask for the rescue, if he would behave, is like, I could be the one that goes, shh, you're safe now. Brad Pitt steals the line from him, and then all of a sudden you had the idea Brad Pitt was gonna die, and he is just obliterated, like on the spot. You're like, I was not ready for that.
And so yeah, now that they're just, you know, two people out in the jungle who have to like figure out how to exist and like
in a sparkly jumper.
Which I really like that. So the other conceit is Sandra Bullock has to go like romping around the jungle in like a sequins onesie. And it is a joke, and it's like a funny joke, but it also, it becomes like plot relevant later.
Yes, which I think is great. Yeah.
When they murder two people on motorcycles.
Yes. Oh. Well, and that goes to another trope of a lot of women in action movies in general, is like they are doing all of these stunts in clothing that is just, no one who is a professional would be wearing that.
I mentioned that Chris Pratt in Jurassic World was like a modern, like he's a throwback to this age where like this guy's, you know, he's like a tough ex-Navy SEAL. But in that movie, we're like, this guy's like just a jerk. In that same movie, is it Jessica Chastain? Or is it?
I think so.
Oh, wait. No, I think it's the other one.
Okay.
Is it Dallas Bryce Howard?
I think it's Dallas Bryce Howard.
Okay. I think you're right. But yeah, she in that movie like runs away from a Tyrannosaurus in like stiletto heels. And there's like a shot of her running
in, like,
away.
A white dress too, right?
Yeah.
Yes. And it is like Bryce Dallas Howard.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm guessing a child of Ron Howard, because I know a lot of his kids are involved in the industry.
As opposed to Rebel Alley, if you're a Arrested Development fan. All right, that was Arrested Development joke. Well, so there's again a moment of like Channing Tatum also, and among the other things he does well, he does sort of simple, he does attractive, he does buff, but he also does sweet, and he brings her like a cheese stick and like a slightly better pair of shoes.
I know. In his very sincere attempt to help. It's like, I knew you wouldn't have good shoes, which is, didn't super help, but also thank you for the cheese stick.
that was the thing is, Channing Tatum, I keep saying dumb jock, and that's not accurate, because he is very intelligent in a lot of ways that he just doesn't articulate in an academic language. And
you're like a human mummy.
But like, that's the thing is, like, there are in fact other types of mummies, and they kept slamming for clarifying she's a human mummy. And I'm like, there are in fact other mummies that are not human. And so they need to stop slamming my poor man.
Yeah.
But mummies are human. Yeah, I know. Yeah. But like in that scene, he basically calls like, you're afraid of living, and so you're in this like paralytic state. he's like, he's right. And he's also, even from the outset where when we get him, he's not like totally, because in the way he's set up, there's like a scene where she's on her book tour and the publisher has brought in the cover model because all the fans, you know, go goo goo for the cover model. And, you know, it seems like he's going to be like there just soaking up all the attention, but he like genuinely tries to be like, what do you think? And like try to set her up, but then she like doesn't want anything to do with it.
Yeah.
Doesn't he call himself a feminist at some point?
Yes, he does. Like, he was like, well, I'm a feminist and women can do anything, so you're wrong.
I loved that. Delightful.
Yeah. My favorite line from that moment too is when Sandra Bullock is calling on questions and like everyone's like, will you rip off your shirt? And he's like, all right, I'm going to ask this nice academic scholarly looking woman. She's like, can you rip off his shirt?
Young studious woman. Yes, young studious looking woman.
And I'm like, she's going to ask the exact same thing because this is a getaway book. This is what I read when I don't want to read anthropological theory.
Exactly.
This, also, I think a great point of like, when in the book can you unveil the word throbbing?
That was an
excellent like, you don't lead discussion. With throbbing. But they make a point. Actually, it is telling where there's a point where the publisher says something. Like, she's a best-selling author in romance, which is the most lucrative industry in publishing. And that's not wrong. Publishing or romance and... I mean, not like erotica or like romance and like that genre. Like, would you call it erotica, I guess?
Maybe.
Romance does make up like something like 40% of like all like literature that gets published at any given time. And it's crazy. And I know I learned when I was an undergrad that of like all of the romance that is being published, like paranormal romance, so stuff with like monsters and vampires, ghosts, you know, all that is like a huge subsection of that. Like, just there's a massive market for that kind of material. And just like, but it has a huge audience base. And again, another moment of Channing Tatum's like insight is, you know, he says like he was originally embarrassed to be like a cover model for, you know, a paperback romance. And then until like a woman came up and is like, I love you. You're like, you're Dash. And he's like, well, like, how can, you know, something that makes people so happy be dumb?
Which is so wonderful, especially coming from like a male perspective, because I feel like so much of the things that are maybe targeted at women or women really, really like are like seen as dumb or put down as bad. When like there's some really great romance novels out there. There are actually good novels. And it's like, I totally agree that like guilty pleasures can just, they don't have to be guilty. Right?
Yeah.
And that goes back to Sandra Bullock's character, where she is in fact a doctor and she has in fact done this research as the backbone of her romance novels, to the point that Daniel Radcliffe is like, so you can read this language as I learned from The Lost City of D. And I need you to come with me now. And she was like, even, you know, kind of talking it down. It's like, you're not acknowledging all of the intelligent work that goes into producing something like this.
Yeah. And even that's her, like, she sort of is reluctant to admit, you know, because I think like she sort of sees in the beginning, she sees herself like the arc from like aspiring academic to romance novelist or something like that as a descent, right? Or it's like it's like beneath her in some way because she's actually highfalutin and, you know, I use big words. I want to talk about like the intellectual ideas. This is just paltry rubbish. Or Daniel Radcliffe says something. It's like you're silly ladies' books or something. Like, I forget what he says. He says something to that effect. Yeah, but like realizing like this is popular media is important. I will get off my soapbox.
Well, I mean, that's just it too. Is like, damn, she's making so much more money than anyone else of us ever will.
Honestly, Madeline Miller had it right. Like, we need to like pivot out of academia. I mean, also, it's like it's probably 8 times more fun to write like a romance novel than a field report about freaking vase shapes. Or I don't know what you write about. Mine are about like this metaphor in this author's text.
Like, but the amount of cavities on this individual's teeth is
wouldn't you rather write about things that are throbbing?
Always. That has to be a thing though, aren't there? There have to be like ancient Roman romance novels. That has to exist.
I feel like that is a that is a subgenre that, like, if it doesn't exist yet, it should. Like a rom, because we this is the thing, like, we complain about, like, all movies about ancient Rome are about, like, they're inevitably about soldiers.
I can answer this question, and yes, it's in Christian romance novels where you go back into Roman times as and you will usually have a dichotomy between a Roman and a Christian woman or something along those lines, and she has to convert him to
You are describing the plot of Quo Vadis.
Yeah, I was like, are you saying that Quo Vadis is a romance novel? No.
It kind of is. That's what happens. Yeah, she
what happens. Yeah. Genre of Christian romance novels.
That's so specific, and yet, like, when you say it out, no, but like when you say it out loud, I'm like, well, of course it is. Christians want to get horny. Like, I don't know.
Okay, I just Googled ancient Roman romance novels, and there's a lot of stuff that's popping up. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because, like, half of what's hot in Christian romance novels is converting people to Christianity.
Well, yeah, like, there's a lot of, like, how to describe it, there would have to be a lot of, like, setup. Like, one, they would need to be converted. Two, you would probably need to be wed. Yeah. And I guess on this logic, we could also group Twilight into this genre as well, which, like, follows that same, right? Because she has to be...
Yes, they have to get married before they have sex.
Mm-hmm.
At 18! And this is how you know.
Or else damnation.
It's like, we need to start teens and preteens into the, we got to get them into the pipeline of the hard stuff. So we're going to start them light.
Anyways. Okay. So we've talked about Brad Pitt, talked a little bit about romance novels. We could also talk, one thing, a touch that I liked about the movie was that the Lost City, such as it was kind of, like, was somewhat realistic, right? Like, the actual excavation of the Lost City was a bunch of stone walls, you know? Like, in another movie, it would be, like, the Lost City, and then they pull back the gate, and it's, like, a full-on, like, monumental palace or whatever. But, like, no, it's just, like, it's a bunch of rooms with stone walls and houses or something like that, which is, like, if the city were to have existed or something. Like, that's what archaeological sites look like.
Exactly. You know?
Yep. They're all very... underwhelming. I have a...
Yeah, I was like, were you going to say boring, Colin?
I was going to say underwhelming, which is, it leads me to a memory ingrained in my brain when I was in Italy, and we're all classicists, but there was a professor of Renaissance art history, and there was, like, one day in our semester where it was, like, his day. It was Tegmeyer's day, and we were in Naples, and he's like, you're with me today, and he's like, no more, like, we're not going into a field where there's a bunch of rocks that you know the professor just put there the night before, and we're just looking at, like, a pile of rubble. Like, we're going to see some real shit. Like, let's look at some Caravaggios and, like, amazing chapels in Naples and, like, this incredible marble work. And then I had this moment where he was describing, like, the archaeological sites. I'm like, oh my God, you're right. Like, all of these sites are just, like, a bunch of rocks in a field. That's all it is. It's literally, like, a rock in a field.
To be fair, yes, it is a rock in a field. And I also love Caravaggio. You can't not, but.
Well, the guys that Caravaggio murdered didn't love Caravaggio. That's my favorite story. So he kept killing people.
I know. He was such an asshole. But no, now I forget where I was going with this at
the rocks, all. The rocks in the
fields
are cool. The
rocks in the fields are actually really cool.
Yeah, they're well done. I will say there's a great, if you've heard of Eddie Izzard as a comedian, they have a great, a much older set about the Trojan War and Paris and Helen. But then he talks about, like, archaeology on TV, and it's like, it's really slow. I was like, where's the bulldozers? Get them in here and kick that skull out of the way. And then he's like, and they always find a series of small walls.
Yes, that's what it is.
We have a series of small walls, and then they bring someone in very learned and has a beard, and maybe they're brushing with the beard, I don't know. And they're pointing to different rooms. They're like, Tutankhamun played his banjo there, and the elephants are dancing over there. And it's like, you're making this up. And I'm like, that is the most accurate description of archaeology I've heard in a while.
I just remember having, like, it was like 8 a.m. in a bus in Naples, and just being like, it's just a bunch of rocks in the field that somebody just put there. And I'm like, oh my God, you're right. Like, this is dumb. And I'm sitting there stressing. And like, I remember stressing because I had an exam where they took us to, I think, Paestum. They took us to one of the temples in Paestum, and like one of the more ruined ones. And it was like, you had, like, the exam was basically like, make a diagram, like a chart, you know, chart out the temple. And of course, like, all the columns are falling over. So you're trying to figure out, like, how many columns were there? Like, what's the dimensions? Is it the temple shape? It does it have an opisthotomos? It does not have an opisthotomos? Is it one of the, like, all that stuff? And then, you know, date the temple. I think I was like 50 years off in my dating schema.
That's not bad.
Not bad.
It was B plus. And I was like,
oh, come on. 50 years off, I think, does not seem that bad.
Mm-mm. Art history.
And then but the part of it, there's always this part of my brain which is like, what if someone just built it differently? Like, what if someone, like, like, what if, and like, I have all these thoughts all the time of like, if, like, my behavior, it, how would it be studied by a future archaeologist? Like, if I collected 70s memorabilia, would an archaeologist 2,000 years from now think that my house was, or like, you know, that I was happening in 1975 when really it's 2022, but I just happened to collect 70s memorabilia or what? You know.
I play that game all the time. What will future archaeologists think? I've got a ton of lithic material sitting in my office closet because I need to figure out what to do with this. Like, they're going to think I'm producing stone tools here. Really crappy stone tools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I don't know. Like, well, they think my PlayStation was some kind of ritual. Was it a ritual?
Yes.
I guess it was.
Yes.
Well, you think about data access and sort of like how floppy disks and even DVDs now, it's like having the ability to get information off of those things is like a type of excavation already, right? Mm-hmm.
That's a whole Cowboy Bebop episode, actually.
Yes. It's a great episode because they need to find a VHS player. And it's like,
it's where the fuck
do
you find
a VHS beta player? They need to find a beta player. It was dated even before.
And like that kind of thing, it's like, you know, in 2,000 years, are they going to be able to read any of our material? So are they going to know anything about us? Like, if you couldn't see what's on our phones, why are we staring at these weird bricks?
Yeah.
I consider the cloud our Library of Alexandria, and I sometimes ask my students, like, just think how many ancient cat memes were lost in the fires that took out the great
or just
library.
How much, you know, we were actually, I was talking in my Latin class today where, you know, there was like, in the story that we were reading, there were three guys going out, and one is a de albator. He is a whitewasher. Like, he goes over with the paint and he like erases the graffiti so the other guy can paint his new graffiti over it. Mm-hmm. And just like the layers and this would absolutely be a thing in Rome where they're graffitiing all over the place and they're painting over the walls or whitewashing and adding to other people's graffiti. And like, you know, all like being able, just like having to sift through that amount of data breaks the mind, even if it survived, or just even like if Twitter were to survive in some server and future archaeologists could access Twitter.
Oh man. Think about like the chronologies that people would create via Twitter. It'd be like the great fight of 2020.
But we also have the problem too that social media does not represent reality in so many ways. And not to give credit to a not great scholar, but they did make the point saying that cookbooks are not reflective of our daily diets. They might indicate some favorite dishes you might have, but very rarely am I cooking stuff from one of my cookbooks I have.
Yeah.
Yep.
No, and so much of our information about ancient life comes from a literary source, but like, how reflective of lived reality is that? You know, famously, Lysias I, there's a part where they describe the Athenian house. And for years, people were like, the Athenian house is built like this, where there's a woman's room and a man's room, and like they access the rooms via this way. And it's like, this is like literally one, maybe a real court case, maybe a hypothetical court case. Mm-hmm. And you know, lived experience is also so different from how it's, you know, just in the ways of like, we get glimpses of this from epigraphic material of just like, there are so many different ways to live that, you know, we wanted to sort of conceptualize the ancient past in sort of a simplistic way of like, Romans were like this. But really, I mean, there's all walks, and particularly if you get a place like any city of any magnitude, and I bring it back to Rome, but like there was a million people there from all over the world, and like there would have been all sorts of weird lifestyles.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like even before Rome had a million people, you know, like people were moving across the Mediterranean like crazy. I just saw my friend Katie defended her dissertation earlier today.
Yay!
And she does this isotopic study of soldiers who fought in the Battle of Himera in 480. And they come from all over. Like, they are not local to the area. And it's, I don't know, that's in 480. Like, that's crazy. Mm-hmm. That's so cool.
BC, we should add.
BC, apologize, yes. But yeah, it's like people were moving around so much more than we think they were. How did we get here?
We went down our own rabbit hole.
We were talking about the actual archaeological dig that was portrayed in the movie, and it was portrayed very well. And my last note I will say about that is there's nothing more frustrating than when you can't find the wall or the floor. I have dug before, and it's happened at different sites. Ganja Vecchio had this whole thing going on, but like I dug at Azoria, and they're like, all right, we got to the Hellenistic floor, dig underneath it to find like the next level. And I dig underneath, like we continuously keep digging below the Hellenistic level, only to learn that the Hellenistics just destroyed any previous levels. So there's literally
there is no other level.
I have another woe story of all of my experiences with material culture are like in some way, shape, or form kind of like mildly traumatizing to me, because like I had another, in addition to not being able to properly date the temple in Paestum. They also, another exam, I went to Herculaneum and they brought us to one of the houses, and all the other groups got like a great atrium house, standard Roman house. You have your atrium, your, what is it called? Triclinium, your...
Cubicula.
And yeah, like, you know, the rooms arrayed out as, and then the house that I got was a house that basically was like, the property brothers had come through and they're like, we're going to blow out this wall and we're going to build this part. And here's a little garden over here. And like, here's a little kitchen. And it's like, none of it was like standardized, but it was like, it was a house that had gone through at least like three periods of renovation of like, they like expanded in weird ways, you know, a way that like a normal apartment probably would expand in like kind of a strange way, but like none of it was typical. I just got to the point, I was like, one point, I'm like, is this a kitchen or is it a bathroom? I don't even know. I know that it has the tile, so it's like one of the two.
Maybe it's both. That would be horrible.
It's like, if you ever see The League, Jason Mazuka's character, Raffi, has like a joker. He's like, this is my kitchen sink. It's like,
no.
Anyways, I lost my train of thought.
Archaeological excavations.
Back to the sort of the original. I did like one. I did also like that the actual dig of the lost city. Like, they found the lost city, and it was like what you would expect a sort of a city. I mean, it would be incredibly exciting to uncover a site like that, because there was clearly like a huge population on this nondescript Caribbean island. But also the actual, like the final find was very sort of underwhelming. It was understated.
Mm-hmm.
Because it wasn't a huge temple. It wasn't like in The Mummy, for example, where there's like a room full of gold.
Yeah.
Or
it was basically a mausoleum. A, mm-hmm.
Yeah,
tomb.
And like a little one, like a humble one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you have looked at a lot of archaeology, like there's a really famous picture of like a burial where two individuals, it looks like they're embracing each other. And I kind of loved that they kind of recreated that within the sarcophagus there. And then, okay, admittedly, them getting into the sarcophagus and laying on top of human remains. And I was thinking back to Jonathan in The Mummy, where he's hiding out in the coffin, hanging out with the mummy. And it's like, yeah, dead human remains in the bedroom, sleeping, have done that. And why is that a thing that I've done? And Elijah's done it too.
More context to that.
We probably
story,
do.
Christy.
We probably do.
No, we'll just leave it.
Okay. No, yeah, you don't want to know why we sleep with dead bodies sometimes as archaeologists.
I mean, it's part of it's. I think any archaeologist would like be able to guess. It's like a storage question and also a protective question. If you don't want to leave something out in the field in the middle of the night and you have wild animals, like you probably bring it inside somewhere. Yeah. And if you don't have a lot of room, if you have too much pottery laid out, maybe you just bring it into where you're sleeping.
Yep.
Maybe where you're sleeping is also just the storeroom. Like, this, all of these are possibilities.
I just hate that, like, Hollywood has caught on to it somehow. They're like, yeah, archaeologists definitely do
Yeah, but I'm not forced into it, like, at gunpoint by Daniel Radcliffe.
I want to come back to Daniel Radcliffe in a second, actually. Mm-hmm. I have, like two thoughts on him. But I was going to say, like, one, as Christy was talking, I was reminded of, like, actually a bit of visual metaphor, for lack of a better word, where, like, the dead couple embracing in the tomb is reminiscent of the scene where Sandra Bullock and Channing Tatum have to share the hammock together.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
In the way that they are sort of for them, and what does they say? It's like asses in, hands out, or whatever.
Yes.
But they're like hands out.
This imagery of like the two of them sort of like curled up or snuggling, for lack of a better word, in an enclosed space. They like set it up in a scene where they have to get into a hammock together, and then it pays out where they see basically their, I guess, historical precedent mm-hmm. in the archaeological remains, and then they have to get on the, you know, to sleep in them. But I was like,
I see what you did there.
Yeah, I just had a connect.
This movie just did so well on so many things. Like, I hope it has staying power, because like it's
doing quite well for the pandemic box office. So yeah,
it's also Sandy B's last movie for a while. She is taking a break from acting. So, yeah,
tragic.
But you know, good one to go out on. Solid.
That's true. That's true.
All right, so let's talk about. The lovable boy wizard gone eccentric billionaire.
Yes. I just have to say, like, I actually really love all of Daniel Radcliffe's career choices mm-hmm. post Harry Potter, because that is a tough thing to get away from. Like, you know, like starting out so young and being part of such a huge franchise, it is really like the gravity of that is like really hard to escape.
Mm-hmm. Yes. For sure.
And like, how do you read it? I mean, we were talking about the way pop culture that is primarily associated with young women is generally kind of denigrated or treated as less serious. And this is like things like, think of like Zac Efron and like the escape velocity he needs to get away from High School Musical mm-hmm. Or like the way, you know, like that, things like that can kind of pull an actor down. Like, cause like Daniel Radcliffe, like, you know, cause he is Harry Potter and, you know, like what kind of career choices? And like consistently, he is basically just like gone for like some of the weirdest movies you could ever go for. Like mm-hmm. I don't know if either of you saw Swiss Army Man, where he plays like a farting corpse, basically.
Yeah. I know the premise. I have not seen it, but I'd seen clips.
Same.
With Paul Dano, or he was in another movie whose title I forget, where basically like guns are like nailed onto his hands, and he's part of like a kind of like weird death game. He just goes for like weird and odd. And I mean, I guess this even goes back to like, even when he was still Harry Potter, he did Equus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, which was like kind of a bizarre choice. And I really kind of like that for him, of like him being able to sort of try to like, cause it's really hard to like carve out your own sort of actoral like persona. Cause he's not a movie mm-hmm. star in the same way that like Brad Pitt is a movie star. You know, like Brad Pitt is kind of always Brad Pitt. Whereas Daniel Radcliffe is like Harry Potter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think I also really like that Daniel Radcliffe has also done roles where he just plays like the exact, I guess, opposite of mm-hmm. Harry Potter. Like mm-hmm. I like the evil Dan Radcliffe. I think that is fun and disturbing and kind of weird, just maybe because we sort of have this kind of wholesome good guy vibe that he kind of comes
with. He did Horns, where he's like a guy who like turns into the devil.
Yeah, where he was, what was the one where he's like infiltrating a neo-Nazi?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Something, and that was terrifying. But yeah,
another thing I like about this and his portrayal in this role is that I keep saying like evil eccentric billionaire, because that's like that's the role usually, but what this is he's privileged, he's got untold money, and he's like, I heard you like cheese, I bought every cheese mm-hmm. for you.
Yeah,
like he is also earnest in some ways. He's forcing Sandra Bullock because he has no choice. Like there's literally a time limit on when he can find this site. He is, you know, he feels really put out, like he's not being acknowledged for his personal accomplishments because he's been overlooked in favor of his brother. Like you can really understand these motivations. There's still like first world problems, white man problems, situation.
Insecure. It's like a male insecurity where like he feels slighted and unappreciated. So the way he overcompensates is like, I need to do something amazing. I need to do something no one's ever. We're gonna find the lost city of Atlantis.
Yeah, Yeah. And like the movie Atlantis, I remember you guys talking about this, like the number of people who die in that movie versus like a few people die. And it's very highlighted, like just how traumatic it is every time someone dies.
Sorry, I'm just thinking when the guys, the motorcycle guys, go off the cliff, and they're like, he might have gone off the cliff anyway. It's like, it's not like we killed them.
That's what I loved was like, and the moment with Brad Pitt, his head being shot basically, and Channing Tatum's reaction, while funny, is also like, I could also, that be my panicked thought process, is like, oh my god, I think brain is on me. It's in my mouth. I can taste his thought. It's like, it seems ridiculous, and except like, you just saw that happen. Like, are you really firing off on all cylinders when something like that happens? Yeah.
The expectation for action heroes to be sort of hyper competent at all times, right? Where like, that was Brad Pitt. He's hyper competent all the time. And Channing Tatum is like, when people are shooting at him and there's blood gets on him, he like, oh, you know. You know what? And this is a weird connection I just made, but I don't know if any other of you have seen Evangelion, Neo Genesis Evangelion. Jesus Christ. Let me like take three tries to say that. Neo Genesis Evangelion, where like, it's kind of a play up on like the Gundam sort of like manga, like super mecha suits, where it's like, yeah, we get into the giant robot suit and fight aliens. Where like, in reality, if you took a teenager and put him in a giant robot suit, he'd have a mental breakdown.
Yep.
Which is what Neo Genesis is kind of about, where like, basically this like being in the giant robot suit makes the kid like depressed as hell.
No shit.
Yeah. And so, gosh, where did I start with all of that? Just like, oh, what I liked is that Daniel Radcliffe isn't necessarily evil, and he's not necessarily trying to kill a bunch of people. And he's not killed at the end either. He is just appropriately captured and hopefully arrested, but let's be serious. He has enough money to buy his way out of jail. So, like,
Well, I think it's also maybe going along with the whole there is no treasure sort of thing. It's like Daniel Radcliffe is already rich as hell, and like, he still isn't happy. And like, he's still looking for things that like give him that acclaim that we've talked about and that validation. And I think it, you know, so many billionaires today are going to space.
Or buying Twitter. If you're on a post date this episode, that's what's happening in the news as we're recording this.
Yeah. So I just I see that he's a very real villain. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the evil is maybe there, but not. Yeah, but you still understand it.
The moral is really no amount of money or personal chaos or accomplishment is going to make up for your parents' love.
Which just comes back to human nature. This is a movie about human nature, and I love it.
Yeah.
So I had two thoughts of like how to end this out.
All right.
One is, what do you do in your daily life that is going to confound future archaeologists? And my second question is, two, if you were to write a romance novel, I want to know the premise of the romance novel going to write.
Ooh.
Yeah, now I have to think on it. Because I already mentioned that, like, I make my students make stone tools, and I have them kept in, I have all of the debitage kept in buckets for litter. It's great to store them. I don't know what to do with them.
I don't know. You could like make concrete, maybe. Like, I don't know.
I don't know. I'll find something.
Yeah, I'll find something. I'm trying to think of what I do in my daily life. I think maybe like the way I make coffee would confound archaeologists, because like, I make a large amount of coffee, but I don't drink it all in the morning. I like save some. And I drink iced coffee in the afternoon. And so it's like, I don't, the amount of glasses that I use to drink my coffee is exponentially gross. Which I don't know if that would confound anybody, but it's like, how many units of caffeine do, you know, Americans drink in?
And I'm thinking too seriously of what's actually going to be preserved, because it's like, well, they won't even know that shit, so.
Eli, I'm going to make another bid for why you need to play video games, and you need to play Horizon Zero Dawn, which is set in like the super future.
That's very fun.
After society has collapsed, and there is like, you meet like a future archaeologist, and he's collecting like basically coffee mugs, and like, you have to go around and like collect coffee mugs, and he's trying to figure out like, are these ritual objects? like they show up in certain places and they have certain designs on them.
Yes.
And like, and then like your character, well, like maybe people just drank out of them. He's like, no, that's too simple. It can't be that.
Yeah, it's like I can think of things that archaeologists do that will confuse future archaeologists, like putting piles of brick from location in which they're found. It's like, and they've been weighed and dump.
And we're done.
And it's like, eventually, this is all like the mountain's going to erode down and pull it under. It's like, why is there a pile of brick here? It looks Roman, and yet it doesn't seem to be part of the building. What the f*** were people doing?
Yeah.
I feel like also, not that it's a... I feel like landfill. Can you imagine? Like, so much of archaeology is based on people's garbage, but the kind of garbage we produce today, like, I don't want to go dig up a landfill. No. No way.
No way.
I think they're going to wonder why I have exactly 1,000 plastic bags, like, all stuffed up in them themselves and, like, stuffed into various closets.
Yeah. It's so hard because it's, like, so much of what your daily life is seems really normal. And it's, like, the things that we take for granted for being normal is, like, what is going to confound people of the future. I'm like, you mean people consumed food on plates? It wasn't just a pill. Like, you know, like, how future stuff is like, oh, you just take a pill and you get all your nutrition from it. It's like, what are these flat things for?
Should we pivot to the romance novel?
Oh, man, I was thinking too hard about the first question.
I know.
Yeah.
I feel like there's so many possibilities.
Ugh. Yeah, I mean, how can you outdo the Christian romance of Roman wooing young Christian girl about to be martyred in the Colosseum?
Good Lord.
Well, one obvious choice is you go the opposite way, which is this is my iconoclastic sort of attitude, which is like devout Christian proselytizing in, I don't know, wherever it is, you know, Corinth in the Roman Empire. And they have a moment, they're like, maybe, what if I don't? Like, what if I just, just chilled out?
I will say, reading Corinthians in the context of the idea of, I think it's Paul going to Corinth during the Isthmian Games, trying to get people to convert to Christianity. It just cracks me up.
It's like, no, man, we're busy. We got shit going on.
It's again, like, it'd be like going to Burning Man and trying to get people.
Ooh, okay. Oh. Okay, actually, Chrissy, you've given me an idea.
Okay.
Isthmian Games. All right.
Okay.
Picture this, a young charioteer, enslaved, bought from war, bought from enslaved parents or something, but like a prodigy behind the chariot. Who is the owner of the horses?
Is it Kaniska? Say it's Kaniska.
Yes!
Yeah!
Oh, this is, please write this. I want to read it.
Sultry, passionate, hot. He's the hotshot chariot racer. He is going to be the key. She's the woman trying to break into the male sphere of the Olympic Games, I guess. Is that when she won? Was it the Olympics?
Yeah, she won the Olympics. She was the first Olympic victor, female Olympic victor.
Okay, we can do some trial runs. And like, it's like he is the ticket in, but like a fiery romance blossoms between the two.
I'm on board. This so bad.
I'm on board.
It's got everything we want for like forbidden love, right? Yep, like it's bound by like social class and status.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But also like it is a sort of like feminist book where it's like by him winning, he is going to make her an Olympic victor.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And like break that respective glass ceiling.
See, I think I'm going to take it further and queer things up a little bit because I think of like the stories of men wanting to break into women's festivals to see what's going on.
Ooh,
and so they cross dress to break in. Mm-hmm. But it's like, I really like the thought of like, this guy cross dresses to go see what's happening at the Thesmophoria and then realizes he really likes dressing up as a woman and hanging out with them.
You know, you've got on your hands, you've got a trans Euripides.
That's true. Yeah.
Yes, I do.
Oh my God, I love it.
But still manages to fall in love with a woman, but as a woman. And it's just, and Dionysus
Reverse
does
Mulan.
In fact show up as the wingman to help out because we can do that.
Yes, we can.
If Dionysus is adamant about anything, it's like there are no rules.
Exactly.
The rule is there are no rules.
That is my pitch.
I like it. It's Reverse Mulan starring Euripides.
Yes. I don't know, going off of the maybe the Dionysus storyline, I want an actual fun retelling of Ariadne on the island, meeting Dionysus, falling in love. That would be awesome.
How does Dionysus, like, how does he, like, court? How does he date?
Yeah, like, how does that happen?
You want to hear my goat song?
It's a shame we've already missed Valentine's Day.
No.
Want to hear my goat song? I would totally get that on a cookie.
Oh, no.
I love it.
I think the drink that I made was very strong because that was very fun.
Which one did you do?
I did the Achilles Smash Teal. Side promo, Liv Albert's cocktail book finally came out, and it's got, I'm going to make the Minthe Mojito tomorrow, and I'm very looking forward to that.
I think Nick is at the store right now because I couldn't go earlier to get all of my cocktail things, but I'm going to go for a muddled Maenad, again with our Dionysus.
I wanted to try that one. I was not convinced that I could find a blood orange, but it's like, I really want to try that one. That one sounds good.
I'm still in the. I'm trying to generate more romance novels. Honest to God, I am legitimately considering my pivot out of academia right now.
Yes.
I would write the Kaniska and her charioteer romance.
Please do. Do you guys want to hear the summary of one of these that I found when I just Googled?
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Do it. Do it.
I can't. Oh my God. It's so.
You got this, Eli.
Okay. I'm just gonna laugh. This is called Empress of the Seven Hills by Kate Quinn. It is from 2012. Brash and headstrong, Vix is a celebrated ex-gladiator returned to Rome to make his fortune. The sinuous? Is that the word they're using? Elusive Sabina is a senator's daughter who craves adventure.
Sensuous?
Is it sensuous or actual sinuous?
Yeah.
There's a weird spelling going on. There's like three different O's. It's maybe a typo.
it might be sinuous, meaning like
the wiry.
Yeah, it's like
lots of sinews. Like
that's basically what it means. Like
so weird.
Thin. Oh, let's read it as thin. I guess I don't know.
Okay,
but I guess you're like you feel like it should be sensuous, right? Like
it's yeah. It really should. All right. Well, Sabina is a senator's daughter who craves adventure. Sometimes lovers, sometimes enemies. Vix and Sabina are united by their devotion to Trajan. I'm sorry. This goes on, but I like can't do it. Oh my God.
Oh, all right. We've gotten way off kilter. We should probably sign off. Unless anyone has any closing thoughts about the movie.
It was silly and delightful.
I encourage archaeologists to go see it. Yeah, go see it. It's really fun.
Yeah. Good development in the evolution of the genre of adventure archaeology, which is kind of our new theme for the next couple of episodes.
Yeah.
All right. So, cue the music. Thank you again for listening. If you enjoy what you hear, you can find us at movieswedig.com. Follow us on Twitter at @digmovies. As usual, like, review, and subscribe. You can find us on most streaming services. And we'll be back next episode for more adventure archaeology, maybe about ancient Egypt.
Ooh.
Yeah. All right. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.